From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, officials may expand the search area for missing Malaysian airliner. U.S. says China is engaged in massive land reclamation in the South China Sea. A call to beef up U.S. counter-ISIL efforts in Syria.
I would like to see the United States government take the train and equip program, which is currently in preparation, and put it on steroids.
And looking at gender equality around the world, it's all ahead. I'm Susan Yockey. Malaysia, China, and Australia say the search area for the missing Malaysian Airlines jet MH370 will be doubled if no trace of the plane is soon found. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports the announcement followed a joint meeting of government ministers in Kuala Lumpur today.
Amid the continuing and so far fruitless search for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, the primary interested parties have been contemplating what to do next if nothing is discovered in the current area of exploration. Speaking to reporters after a meeting with Australian and Chinese officials Thursday, Malaysia Transport Minister Liao Tong Lai announced an expanded search will commence to the north of the current sector in the Indian Ocean, off Australia's west coast.
If the aircraft is not found within the current 60,000 square kilometer search area, we have collectively decided to extend the search by an additional 60,000 square kilometer within the highest probability area.
Looking for wreckage in that extended area could take a year. MH370 disappeared on March 8th of last year. Since then, more than 60% of the initial search area has been covered. And the ministers of Australia, China, and Malaysia are still expressing optimism the Boeing 777 will be located in the sectors currently being probed, where analysts have indicated the passenger plane is most likely to have gone down. Australia's Deputy Prime Minister, Warren Truss, says even though the best equipment in the world is being utilized to look for the aircraft, it is a very challenging underwater search area, 5 to 6 days' journey from the closest port.
The weather conditions are challenging. The remoteness of the site is challenging. The depth of the sea in the search area is challenging. The roughness of the seabed is challenging.
Two-thirds of the passengers on MH370 were Chinese citizens. Chinese Transportation Minister Yan Chuangtang told reporters his government's commitment to discovering precisely what happened to them is undaunted. No matter the challenges that will be confronted, he says, China will stand alongside friends Australia and Malaysia to continue the search until the aircraft is found and the mystery of this unprecedented tragedy in the aviation industry is solved. The ministers declined to answer questions about how much the additional search would cost. There were 239 passengers and crew members on MH370, which took off from Kuala Lumpur for Beijing before veering off course and then vanishing from radar screens. Investigators believe the aircraft traveled for thousands of kilometers, perhaps placed on a different course by its pilot, before running out of fuel and falling into deep, remote waters. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The commander of the U.S. Pacific Command told U.S. lawmakers Wednesday China is engaged in a fairly massive land reclamation effort on contested islands in the South China Sea. VOA's Victor Beatty reports Admiral Samuel Locklear also says despite a slowdown in its economy, China continues to maintain double-digit increases in its defense spending as it pursues a comprehensive military modernization program.
U.S. Navy Admiral Samuel Locklear told members of the House Armed Services Committee the Chinese are showing no slowdown in the pace of their military modernization, particularly in the Navy. He says 5 years of double-digit increases continue into 2015, allowing them to gain influence in the South and East China Seas.
Now, they are doing this in combination with what we have seen to be a fairly massive land reclamation in the Spratly Islands and in upgrades to facilities in the Paracel Islands, which are the two regions in the South China Sea.
The PACCOM commander says this gives the Chinese the ability to deploy, base, and resupply what he calls lower-end or non-combatant vessels like maritime patrol boats in the region.
It allows them to exert basically greater influence over what's now a contested area. It expanded land features down there also could eventually lead to the deployment of things such as long-range radars, military and advanced missile systems, And it might be a platform for them to, if they were ever wanted to establish an air defense zone down there, for them to be able to enforce that from.
Locklear says up to now, Southeast Asian nations, including the Philippines and Vietnam, who also have claims to the Spratlys and Paracels, have had little success in formulating an effective response to China's actions. Images released by the satellite imaging company Digital Globe Tuesday show Woody and Duncan Islands in the Paracels east of Vietnam have expanded significantly. Other images show the speedy Chinese construction of at least 7 islands in the Spratly group between Vietnam and the Philippines. A Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman has indicated the artificial islands will be used for military and civilian purposes. At the same congressional hearing Wednesday, Undersecretary of Defense Christine Wormuth said China's maritime activities have created significant friction with its neighbors.
We've urged China to show restraint and to refrain from further activities that undermine regional trust. We also have continued to urge China to clarify the meaning of its ambiguous 9-line claim as a starting point, as a way to start reducing tensions and provide greater transparency to countries in the region.
Last week, President Obama said where we get concerned with China is where it is not necessarily abiding by international norms and rules and is using its sheer size and muscle to force countries into subordinate positions. But the president said he thought China's growing maritime assertiveness could be solved diplomatically. China has accused Washington of taking sides in the dispute and of interfering in regional affairs, including Beijing's territorial disagreements with Japan over islands in the East China Sea, in order to, quote, salvage its waning influence in the Asia-Pacific region. John Blaxland, an Australian National University Defense Senior Fellow, says Washington is frustrated by watching these developments from the sidelines. Blaxland says China is backing up its claims with massive resources and redrawing the South China Sea map.
It's inventing islands that are hardly likely to be uninvented. So this is unprecedented. The potential for conflict amongst the scattered Spratly Islands claimants is growing, there's no question, and the stakes are high. But from China's perspective, securing its trade routes and its resources, these are vital national interests.
And he says China is pursuing its ambitions with unmatched determination, and U.S. policy must be carefully calibrated.
Taking sides in supporting an ally over a contested claim in defense of their concerns and in challenging China and its potential positioning of radars and missiles risks sparking a war.
He says, on balance, China's claims to the islands are as strong, if not stronger, than those of the other claimants. He says China will push as hard and as far as it can until it hits resistance that will take it to the brink of conflict, but not over. Blaxland says ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, must act with resolve and unity if it wants its member states' claims to be respected. Otherwise, he sees little prospect the dispute will be contained or wound back. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
The United Nations is preparing to resume peace talks on Libya, but analysts warn that even if negotiations succeed, war could continue among militant groups not involved in the peace process. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Cairo.
In some ways, the growth of the Islamic State group has strengthened Libya's chance at successful peace talks by creating a common enemy. The United Nations says the increasing number of terrorist attacks amid continued fighting has made peace talks the only option to resolve the crisis. As talks continue, however, not everyone is hopeful. Khalifa Haftar leads the military loyal to Libya's internationally recognized government based in the eastern city of Tobruk. He says he is not against a political solution, but if it fails, there should be a military solution. The United Nations says progress has been made in talks this week in Algeria, and they are set to pick up again in Morocco on Thursday. The UN Special Representative for the Secretary General for Libya, Bernardino Leon, has warned continued violence could derail the process.
We are concerned, not only because there are human lives that are lost, but also because this has an impact in the dialogue. And the ones behind these killings are not only showing total lack of respect for life, but also are using these killings just to put pressure on this dialogue.
Chief among those against successful dialogue are extremist groups, including the Islamic State group and Al-Qaeda, he says. Neither group nor its allies is participating in the talks. Chatham House analyst Tim Eaton says militant groups have grown more powerful in Libya since the government essentially split in two last year.
Jihadists have been present in Libya for a long time, but their relative importance and strength has been a lot less than the other militias. So they have essentially profited from the lack of centralized authority.
And it's not just extremist groups that are excluded from the peace talks, Eaton says, and any deal would be difficult to implement. The two rival governments are accompanied by rival militaries, but both militaries are made up of several militias, lacking a single central command. There are other militias unaffiliated with either side as well. None of these groups can be counted on to simply stop fighting because negotiators say so.
The big question will be, what do the militias think of that? What do the leaderships of those militias think about it? They're not just going to advocate their own dissipation immediately following some kind of political deal.
And as the chaos in Libya deepens, its neighbors fear the conflict and resulting rise in extremist groups are destabilizing the rest of the region. Arab leaders have called for the creation of an international force to fight the Islamic State militants in Libya. But critics say outside involvement in Libya could just further complicate the war. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
A new Atlantic Council report is recommending the U.S. beef up its train and equip effort in Syria to help combat ISIL or ISIS. We asked one of the authors, Fred Hoff, what he would like to see done.
I would like to see the United States government take the train and equip program, which is currently in preparation, and put it on steroids. Really try to turn it into something that can make a difference for Syria, make a difference in the war against ISIL, and make a difference in general for the effectiveness of United States policy.
How could they do that?
The current train and equip program envisions training 15,000 anti-Assad rebel fighters over 3 years. This will be a drop in the bucket, given the situation in Syria, and God only knows what that situation would look like 3 years from now. We're recommending something much more robust. We're recommending the creation of what we call a Syrian National Stabilization Force. This would be a force of about 50,000, three motorized infantry divisions plus a headquarters element, and it would have a military mission of stabilizing the entire country, and that would involve, if necessary, overcoming militarily any combination of enemies to the stabilization of Syria.
Would this include U.S. boots on the ground, as they like to say?
It would not. We would anticipate that even if there were protected areas in Syria, areas where a lot of effective recruitment could be done for this force, that the actual training would take place in neighboring countries, primarily Turkey and Jordan.
There has been some opposition in the U.S. to getting involved in any more wars in the Middle East. What is your reaction to that?
I agree. I agree that the general inclination about getting involved in more wars in the Middle East is a good one. The pertinent fact right now is that we're involved in a war in the Middle East, a war against ISIL. And the problem we face at the end of the day here is that to degrade and destroy ISIL, which is the objective of the President of the United States, it's going to require legitimate governance, not only in Iraq, but in Syria. The vacuums that ISIL has been able to fill
need to be filled with something else, namely legitimate governance. My co-authors and I believe that the creation of a national stabilization force made up entirely of Syrian soldiers is a good first step in that direction.
What if the U.S. doesn't do this sort of action?
If it doesn't, I think we may face the prospect of chasing these ISIL guys from 30,000 feet using F-16s and F-18s. The problem in Syria is that there is no ground component to complement the efforts of American and coalition pilots. And, I think it's an axiom of military science that you're not going to achieve victory in the absence of real ground power. And the current train and equip program, even if it moves smoothly, even if it accomplishes its technical objectives of training 15,000 people over 3 years, really cannot accomplish what the President of the United States wants to do.
Fred Hoff, Senior Resident Fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East in Washington. It was almost 20 years ago that representatives of 189 countries met at a UN conference in Beijing and adopted a plan of action to achieve gender equality around the world. Now, two decades later, the University of California, Los Angeles World Policy Analysis Center has issued a report examining what the Beijing Platform for Action has achieved. While the report highlights advances in some areas, it also points to places around the world where full equality has not been achieved, including the United States, where it says there is still a lack of adequate maternal leave policies. From Los Angeles, Elizabeth Lee has details.
A private school teacher who wants to be identified only as Barbara because she's worried about repercussions for speaking out is expecting her second child and is worried about making ends meet.
Most private schools do not have a maternity leave program because they're too small and it's too expensive.
Barbara can use 20 days of her paid sick and vacation leave, but if she has to take time off after that, she would not be paid. She says the solution is disability insurance, but that would only pay a percentage of her income when she's not working.
I was insulted that, having a child, bringing into the society another productive member who will be paying taxes their whole life and working for the betterment of their society, hopefully, that there was no thought behind the label of, you're disabled because you're having a child. That seemed to be sort of crass to me.
Similar experiences are not uncommon in the United States, says Jody Hyman, founder of the University of California, Los Angeles's World Policy Analysis Center.
While 188 countries, that's virtually every country, has paid maternity leave, the United States now really just with Papua New Guinea, Suriname, six small South Pacific island states are the only countries without it.
U.S. law requires employers to provide 12 weeks of unpaid leave. Companies with fewer than 50 employees are exempt because for some businesses, paying for maternity leave is a financial hardship, says Chris Tilley, who heads the UCLA Institute for Research on Labor and Employment.
Saying, we should be able to have families and raise families, we should be able to retire, those are social needs, not necessarily business needs. So from a business viewpoint, it doesn't necessarily make sense to fund these things. Businesses have resisted.
A few states do have their own paid family leave programs. California, the first statewide program in the U.S., pays 55% of a person's wages for up to 6 weeks of time off through the state's disability insurance program. Jody Hyman says federal legislation to mandate paid maternity leave is necessary because a woman's parenting role is connected to an income gap.
While single women who have never married have earnings that look a lot like men in the United States, moms earn 76 cents on the dad's dollar. So that's where the real gap is.
But before paid maternity leave becomes federal law in the U.S., a cultural shift may be necessary, says Professor Tilley.
And part of the cultural shift is that our allergy to big government regulations stands in the way of trying to decide as a society, how do we make families work?
I have friends who live in Europe. I have friends who live in Asia and even in Canada. And when they hear about our system, they're always horrified and shocked.
For now, Barbara has no choice but to hope her disability insurance and her husband's income will be enough to pay the bills while she takes time off to recover from childbirth and care for her newborn. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
The founder of a credit card company payments company in the western U.S. city of Seattle is taking a huge pay cut in order to give every one of his employees a big raise. Dan Price, owner of Gravity Payments, told his employees this week that he is slashing his own $1 million per year salary to $70,000. He will use that money and company profits so every employee would earn a base salary of $70,000 to be phased in over 3 years. He says the cost of living is rising rapidly in Seattle, and the salary should increase with it. The company currently pays an average of $48,000 a year to its 120 employees. 70 of them will see a wage increase under this plan, and 30 of them will see their salaries double. Price's announcement at a company meeting brought wild applause from his employees, I bet, with some saying it would enable them to start a family sooner, buy a home, or pay off credit card debts or student loans. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
I'm Neil Arcega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The abduction last year and continued disappearance of more than 200 girls from a secondary school in Chibok, Nigeria, drew international attention to a humanitarian crisis caused by the criminal terrorist group known as Boko Haram, wreaking death and destruction across much of that nation's northern half. It also highlighted the sad fact that in far too many places, being a schoolgirl is dangerous business. Girls face the threat of violence on their bus ride to school, the afternoon walk home, and elsewhere. And that's if they can attend school at all. Community leaders may permit only boys to attend class, or schools may be shuttered and used as hospitals or military bases instead. The barriers that prevent girls from going to school vary. What is clear in any community is that education can change everything for a student, offering ideas, experiences, and discoveries. For many girls, education improves their earning power and leaves them less vulnerable to HIV/AIDS, early enforced marriage, and other forms of violence. It places girls on a path to a better life and improving the health, well-being, and economic security of their families and communities. Such possibilities have inspired our nation's efforts to help adolescent girls in other nations stay in school, including an initiative announced by President Barack Obama and the First Lady called Let Girls Learn. From supporting community-based solutions to local problems, to leveraging diplomacy and U.S.-funded education programs that address the needs of girls, this effort aims to knock down barriers that keep far too many adolescent girls from completing their education. It's a signal to the world that the United States is committed to adolescent girls and their education, and to seeing their lives and opportunities change for the better. It's also a signal of our resolve to stand up to those who choose to brutalize, terrorize, and torment. In the face of groups like Boko Haram, we will remain strong and committed to the rights of men and women, boys and girls.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.